Thank you, Jonga Kandemiri. Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Tuesday, March 22nd, 2016. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Chris Gande.
And I'm Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye.
Here are our top stories this evening.
Islamic State claimed responsibility for three explosions that rocked the Belgian capital Brussels today, which left 30 people dead and 130 others injured.
I am 10 minutes from the Brussels International Airport. The situation here is very sad.
The Zimbabwe Farmers Union has welcomed moves by the government to compensate evicted white commercial farmers.
We need to be reasonable in that there were developments that were on these farms which should ordinarily have been paid for.
Some war veterans say Vice President Phelekezela Mpoko and several others should be expelled from the ruling party.
And an environmentalist says proper water conservation methods can generate millions of jobs.
We used to have good systems in place, and a lot of investment was put in water supply and sanitation in urban areas with access to clean water. However, over the years, the situation has deteriorated very much.
These stories and much more coming up. Stay tuned.
Islamic State claimed responsibility for three explosions that rocked Brussels this morning, two at the airport and one at a metro station in the heart of the Belgian capital, killing at least 30 people and injuring more than 130 others. Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel told reporters that, quote, "This is a black moment in our country, and everyone please be calm and show solidarity," end quote. U.S. President Barack Obama reacted to the blast during a speech in Havana, saying America will do whatever is necessary for its ally Belgium to bring those who are responsible to justice. A Belgian prosecutor said at least one blast at the airport was probably caused by a suicide bomber. Local media also reported shouts in Arabic at the airport before the explosions. A European security official said one or possibly two Kalashnikov rifles had been found at the site of the airport attack. Local media described a panic on the street and people emerging from the metro with burns and wounds.
Belgian authorities have raised the nation's terror alert level to its maximum level. All flights in and out of the airport have been cancelled, and Brussels' subway system has been shut down as well. Authorities in Frankfurt, London, Paris and Holland have boosted security at their airports in response to the Brussels bombings. The White House said U.S. officials were in close contact with the Belgian counterparts. The explosion came just days after the arrest of key Paris attacks suspect Salam Abdeslam in Brussels that have raised fears of revenge attacks to follow. The attacks also bring to mind the November 13 bombings and shootings claimed by Islamic State that took place in several places around the French capital. For perspective, Studio 7's Blessing Zulu reached Zimbabwean Grace Quinji, who lives in Belgium.
I am 10 minutes from Brussels International Airport. The situation here is very sad, to say the least. It's a very tense situation. Earlier this week, Salah Abdeslam, who was part of the network of the terrorist attack in which 130 people were killed last year, November 13, was arrested. And it seems that a new network had already been put in place. So in spite of the police finding large weapons and explosives, it seems the new network is now in operation.
With all that is going on now, do you feel secure in Brussels?
There's tight security and the debate that is going on. If you listen to what French President François Hollande said earlier on, he said they now have to deal with a combination of making sure citizens are safe, but also respecting civil liberties. So there are a lot of concerns, of course, that tightened security can also go a bit too far in infringing people's human rights. But, of course, at the end of the day, we are better off safe than sorry. And I think Belgium has done well, and I think their response has been incredible.
We also understand that public transport has been suspended. How are people managing to get by?
There are emergency buses. For instance, my mother has just been in one that brought her home, and there are ambulances along all the roads in case anything happens. But taxis and public transport are not operating. I think the main concern right now is to just get people to their homes so that they stay in and are safe until further notice.
Have you managed to talk to anyone from Zimbabwe?
Yes. So far, I have not heard of any casualties or people that I know or any Zimbabweans. But you know that the Chibebes are here. I spoke to, actually, she looked for me, Tatenda Chibebe, and she and her family are safe so far. But I wouldn't know about other Zimbabweans. We just keep praying that they are safe too.
That was Grace Quinji, a Zimbabwean living in Belgium, speaking with Studio 7.
The Zimbabwe Farmers Union, or ZFU, has welcomed moves by the government to compensate evicted white commercial farmers. ZFU Director Paul Zakaria says compensating the evicted white farmers will be the proper way of taking over the farms, but is quick to point out that the compensation is expected to only cater for farm developments, not for the land. Early this month, Finance Minister Patrick Chinamansa announced that the government had started evaluating farms which were once owned by white commercial farmers with a view of paying compensation to the dispossessed farmers. At least 3,500 white commercial farmers lost their land when the government embarked on its controversial agrarian reforms in 2000. There are proposals for new farm occupants to pay for the land in the form of taxes. Zakaria speaks to Studio 7's Jonga Kandemiri about moves by the state to compensate evicted white farmers.
On this matter, we really have to be very strategic. We also need to be reasonable about what has taken place over the years, beginning the year 2000, when this very important resource was transferred from the minority to the majority. We need to be reasonable in that there were developments that were on these farms which should ordinarily have been paid for. And of course, there is a clear understanding that compensation does not also refer to compensating the land itself. It is the development. So as an organization, we have to look at this issue from a very strategic point of view, where worldwide we need also to be sending the proper message that we did not just keep these farms for free as others would want to have it, that we took things and we did not pay for them, particularly the development. And I think, in fact, from an organization point of view, that is the way to go.
Do you see farmers being able to pay?
Well, you know, as far as whether farmers are going to be able to pay, that becomes now a function of how productive the farms are, because they must pay into that pool out of the profits of the farms. So if the farms are not productive, then it will become very, very difficult for the farmers. Currently, farmers are unable to produce. Most of the land is lying idle, as you would know.
That was Paul Zakaria, director of the Zimbabwe Farmers Union, on the line with reporter Jonga Kandemiri from Harare.
Some war veterans say they want Vice President Phelekezela Mpoko, ZANU-PF political commissar Xavier Kasukuwere, and other people identified with Generation 40 or G40 to be expelled from the ruling party. These war veterans have already indicated that a planned meeting with President Robert Mugabe early next month is expected to shape democratic processes in Zimbabwe. Our correspondent Arthur Chigoriwa attended a meeting at the weekend convened by some of the former liberation fighters and filed this report.
Addressing hundreds of former freedom fighters in Chinoy, Matola and West Province on Saturday, former war veteran minister Christopher Muchangwa said their proposed meeting with President Mugabe will have a far-reaching impact on how Zimbabwe is expected to be governed by the ruling party. Muchangwa says the war veterans created the condition for ZANU-PF to flourish in the country and President Mugabe cannot afford to dump them.
He is going to meet the originals. That's where the fate of the party is going to be decided, including those who are sitting in council on these wayward decisions about votes of no confidence. The people who made possible for ZANU-PF to be what it is today in Zimbabwe when it was banned are the war veterans. We created the conditions for ZANU-PF to flourish in Zimbabwe, and the president is going back to the source, which is the war veterans. The first week of April decides the future of the party and the future of the country, not them.
Muchangwa said this organization has made resolutions to force President Mugabe to expel people like ZANU-PF political commissar Seve Akasukwere, Politburo members Jonathan Moyo, Patrick Zhuao and the Hurungwe West member of parliament Sara Mahoka, who are backing a faction known as Generation 40 or G40, believed to be a front for First Lady Grace Mugabe. The group allegedly wants Mrs. Mugabe to succeed her husband. Muchangwa accused G40 members of trying to destroy the ruling party.
The resolution is to have them be dismissed, from expelled from the party. These are the people who are fronting the G40, especially, you know, pushing all these votes of no confidence and simply creating confusion, disunity, and trying to hijack, to steal the people's revolution.
Moyo, Mahoka, Kasukwere and Zhuao were not available for comment as their mobile phones were not reachable. Speaking at the same meeting, Midlands war veteran Francis Zimuto, affectionately known as Black Jesus, said President Mugabe belongs to former freedom fighters and not G40. Zimuto said they will fight to regain President Mugabe on their side and endorse Muchangwa as their leader until the next Congress in 2018.
President Ndewedu is wholly ours, completely. The president is wholly ours. Inasmuch as ZANU-PF is ours, inasmuch as our chairman Muchangwa is ours, is under siege. The president is part of us. We can't do without him.
The meeting, attended by all veterans from 8 provinces, also resolved that no veteran should be expelled from ZANU-PF because they sacrificed their lives to liberate Zimbabwe from the yoke of colonialism. The war veterans also said that they don't want Mr. Mugabe to step down. Muchanga noted that the meeting will be attended by Defense Force Chief Constantine Chiwenga, former 5th Brigade Commander and the current Air Force Chief Vice Marshal Perence Shiri, Army Commander General Philip Vareo Sibanda, Prison Boss Paradzai Zimondi, Police Commissioner General Augustine Chihuri, and several others. Muchangwa was recently expelled from the ruling party and sacked by the president for allegedly insulting the First Family and undermining the authority of the president after he criticized ZANU-PF for allowing Mrs. Mugabe to brutalize party members. Mrs. Mugabe attacked Mnangagwa for allegedly hatching a plan to undemocratically unseat the president. The recent firing of Muchangwa has unsettled war veterans who were on the receiving end recently when police with baton stick and water cannons descended on them as they attempted to convene an indaba in Harare to discuss, among other issues, President Mugabe's succession. While they are still dusting themselves from that violent encounter, President Mugabe on Friday said he does not understand why some of the war veterans want him to step down as he was democratically elected in 2013. Mr. Mugabe said he will step down if ever that is necessary, but he has to serve his 5-year term as stipulated in Zimbabwe's constitution. Reporting for Studio 7 in Chinoy, this is the Arthur Chiboriwa.
Zimbabwe, tonight.
The government censorship board has banned a documentary, Democrats, narrating the constitution-making process in Zimbabwe. The board alleged the film was unfit for viewership within the country. According to the Newsday newspaper, the ban follows an application by Upfront Films to distribute the documentary. The film features MDCT Secretary General Douglas Muonzora and ZANU-PF's Paul Mangwana, who were part of leaders of the constitution-making team.
But first, a look at regional and international news.
Less than a day before a high-profile hearing in the legal standoff between Apple and the FBI, attorneys for the Department of Justice late Monday persuaded a federal judge to cancel the hearing and issue a temporary stay in the case.
And FIFA's ethic committee has opened a bribery investigation into six people involved in the bidding process that awarded the 2006 World Cup to Germany.
Forests and water play an important role in contributing to sustainable development in diverse ecosystems. According to the United Nations, the past 2 years have great significance in people as they highlight the importance of forests and water in everyday life. Dr. Thomas Chiramba, Senior Human Settlement Officer for UN Habitat, responsible for Eastern and Southern Africa, who's also an environmentalist, says water and forests play a key role in the empowerment of people, including Zimbabweans. He tells Studio 7's Chioniso Jani, water conservation plays a critical role in improving the lives of Zimbabweans, especially at a time the world is struggling to tackle the negative effects of the El Nino weather phenomenon.
We used to have good systems in place, and a lot of investment was put in water supply and sanitation in urban areas with access to clean water. However, over the years, the situation has deteriorated very much, contrary to the global trend. And in Zimbabwe, we actually came backwards, which is a tragedy.
Situation in Zimbabwe, how do we attract investors?
We've gotten to this situation because of lack of investment in water and sanitation. So that has resulted in a situation where infrastructure that we had is dilapidated and needs urgent improvement, non-functional. And the lack of investment that I'm talking about also goes not only to water supply and sanitation, but also comes from. As you may know, we had this Kunti Dam. That dam was already on the table, and it was needed to augment the water supply to Harare. And that dam, as we speak, is still not complete, far too long to get completed. And that's an indication that investment has not been forthcoming into the water sector in general, be it water resources management, that's where you find issues like dams, but also in terms of water supply and sanitation, which a lot of relevance to this year's theme on water, which is water and jobs, because if there's no regular water supply and sanitation, that impacts the manufacturing sector, not to speak about what happens in terms of improving agricultural outputs and the jobs that are related to that.
With the effects of El Nino, what can you say in terms of its impact in the rural areas and urban areas?
The impact of El Nino is that we now have prolonged drought. We don't have adequate rains. And again, I want to bring in the issue of investment. Zimbabwe and South Africa were the leading countries in terms of constructing small dams that a lot of farmers used to build on their farms, to irrigate and all that. That investment has since stopped in Zimbabwe. It's not taking place as much because it was partly state-driven, but also by the private sector. That investment is not there. And now, given the situation that we are having this prolonged drought, we are getting less water from the seasons that we have. That has got very serious impact to agriculture and, of course, the jobs that go along with that, because you can't irrigate. The dams don't have adequate water from the perspective even of power generation, which again comes to the issue of how the industry should operate. And then it's a vicious cycle because our industry is based on agricultural production. If you don't produce in agriculture, raw materials for the manufacturing sector are not there. And again, if you don't have electricity, even if you have a few raw materials we have, you can't produce optimally. So it's a vicious cycle. It's a situation that we could have avoided if we had continued investing in the small and large dams. And this is impacting both on rural and urban development.
We all know that right now Zimbabwe gets its electricity, or most of its electricity, from Kariba. What can you tell us in that perspective?
Kariba Gorge Street number 3, I think, which has been on the cards for the last 30 years and needed to be put in place. But again, we've not done so. Lack of investment seems to have done a lot of damage to the country in many aspects. And I'm talking about investment in the water sector in the form of promoting good catchment management, maintenance of the forest, but also in terms of the infrastructure that goes with that to collect water and store water. It also has impacted on the water supply to settlements.
Tobacco levy was slashed by half. That goes towards a forestation program. So what would that mean in Zimbabwe?
The fact that the afforestation levy has been cut and not much resources can be expected there can only worsen a very bad situation that we already had. Catchment management needs to be improved or to be worked on now, because when you have forests, they help you to manage those impacts much better. You retain water. You deal with erosion is a big issue, because erosion impacts on the storage capacity of the dams. If you don't maintain your forests and landscapes, erosion can only go up, and then the small dams that we have will disappear very quickly. So with the investment and the opportunity that we have through those small dams to store water to assist us to go through difficult periods. Tobacco farming is one of those industries, activities, economic activities, that actually have contributed significantly to deforestation, if you may know that. Most of the small-scale farmers actually have done a lot of damage to the forests around them because they're cutting them to process their tobacco. In many cases, that was done in a manner that no thinking was done on what the implications of what they were doing to treat tobacco. And of course, now, water, when it rains, just passes through, and erosion is increased, and all the ability that the river had to retain some water is gone, and managing catchments is everybody's business, and we all need to play our part on that.
That was Dr. Thomas Chiramba, Senior Human Settlement Officer for the United Nations Habitat, responsible for Eastern and Southern Africa, speaking there with Studio 7's Chiwoneso Jani from Nairobi, Kenya.
Some members of the public as well as civic society activists say they are concerned about the sincerity of government in dealing with atrocities like Gukurahundi massacre committed by the North Korean-trained Five Brigade and help bring reconciliation in Zimbabwe. Our correspondent Taurai Shava brings us more.
The concerns came out at a recent meeting in Mlayo, which discussed memorialization and reconciliation. Most of the participants said they were worried about the slow pace in the promulgation of a law that will enable the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission to start work. They said they doubted the sincerity of the ZANU-PF government's efforts in bringing about national healing and reconciliation, particularly in regard to the Gukurahundi atrocities, which they said the government seems intent on brushing aside. A participant who did not want to identify himself for fear of being victimized said he doubts that President Robert Mugabe and his colleagues would do anything that could possibly result in their own prosecution.
If you look throughout the history, you'll discover that no sitting government has ever prosecuted itself. As long as Robert Mugabe and ZANU-PF are in power, there is no justice that is going to be done for the people of Matabeleland.
An estimated 20,000 innocent civilians who were supporters of ZAPU, then led by the late Joshua Nkomo, were killed in Matabeleland and Midlands provinces between 1983 and 1987. They were accused of supporting dissidents that took up arms against the Mugabe government following the brutalization of ZAPU activists by the ruling ZANU-PF party. The participants at the meeting agreed that there is need for government to come clean on the Five Brigade or Gukurahundi atrocities so that those affected, as well as the nation at large, can find closure. Sari Apple, a psychologist and one of the presenters at the meeting, said although it is always difficult to deal with a national violent past, the affected people must be allowed to remember publicly what happened to them or their relatives. Apple said decrees of clemency by governments cannot erase gross abuses or violations done in the past, adding that government should not prescribe how the affected people should remember or memorialize victims of their atrocities. She noted that if society is denied the right to mourn its dead, it suffers what is known as ambiguous loss, whereby survivors will always feel there's something that has to be done about their missing loved ones and there's no closure.
You will hear governments, not just our own government, but other governments will say, well, it's long ago, you must just move on, or don't reopen old wounds. But actually, you can't tell emotions, you can't tell people's psychology how to behave, okay, by decrees. And this is also universal. Some families may move on, others may not, and that's just how it's going to be. If we look around the world, in Spain, for example, the civil war there ended in 1939. That's 80 years ago. And yet now you have the grandchildren of those who died in the civil war demanding exhumations of their grandparents, demanding to know the truth about what happened in the civil war.
Former National Healing Co-Minister Moses Mzilandlovu, who was also a presenter at the meeting, also queried government's seriousness and said ordinary Zimbabweans should not expect those in power to accord them all the expected rights. Director Anna Tinaro of the Organ for National Healing, Reconciliation and Integration allayed the concerns of the participants. She said the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission, which her department has been mandated to help establish, will be operational soon and it will be able to handle any case of abuse or past atrocities as long as they are brought before the commission.
It does not matter who will bring forth an issue. Pre-independence, post-independence, up to today, the commission will be looking at those cases. It is not a commission that has been given a limited period where it starts looking from its cases like the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission. No. Even if we have cases of the 1890s, as long as we have people who can bring those forth, the commission will look at those cases.
Reverend Ray Motsi, a member of the National Transitional Justice Working Group, which convened the meeting, said he understood the concerns over government's apparent lack of commitment to national healing and reconciliation. He, however, challenged participants to utilize every opportunity to raise those concerns and put pressure on government so that it deals with such issues.
We have got a door that is halfway or maybe a quarter open. Let's put our foot or feet in it. Let's not allow it to close. Let's walk in and salvage something out of it.
The National Transitional Justice Working Group is a non-governmental organization that seeks to promote national healing and reconciliation by, among other things, pushing for the telling of the truth about and acknowledgement of past atrocities. Reporting for Studio 7 from Bulawayo, this is Taurai Shawa.
As the socio-economic conditions in Zimbabwe continue to plague youth, in particular those in the rural areas, some organizations are stepping up to assist young Zimbabweans with life skills. Zimbabwe Civic Education Trust, or ZIMSET, is assisting young people in rural areas with the necessary life skills based on the challenges in their particular communities. The program recently graduated its first set of over 50 youths in the pilot program in Domboshawa. That happens to be the topic today for the youth program in our live talk show tonight. And that's the end of the show. But before we go, a quick recap of today's top stories.
Islamic State claimed responsibility for three explosions that rocked the Belgian capital Brussels today, which left 30 people dead and 130 others injured.
The Zimbabwe Farmers Union has welcomed moves by the government to compensate evicted white commercial farmers.
And some more veterans say Vice President Phelekezela Mpoko and several others should be expelled from the ruling party.
And war veterans prepare for a crucial meeting with President Robert Mugabe.
That's our broadcast this evening.
Now, please do stand by for Studio 7 in Ndebele with yours truly, Chris Gande, in Washington. Good night, Zimbabwe.
And our marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye wishing you a pleasant evening and a very good night.